Команда Сталина, о которой повествует Шила Фицпатрик, это по существу синоним слова «политбюро», куда входили ближайшие соратники советского диктатора. Молотов, Берия, Микоян, Ворошилов, Калинин, Орджоникидзе, Каганович, Хрущев, Андреев, к которым позднее присоединились Жданов, Маленков, Булганин, Сабуров, Первухин и Вознесенский. На более раннем этапе в команду входили также Киров и Куйбышев. В ней никогда не было более 8-10 человек, и просуществовала она с конца 20-х годов до смерти Сталина в 1953-м. Существование этой команды – уникальное явление в советской политической истории. Ей удалось практически в неизменном составе, с минимальными потерями, пройти сквозь террор и чистки 30-х годов. Впрочем, время от времени Сталин все же отстреливал своих игроков. Его жертвами стали Бухарин, Рыков, Радзутак, Постышев, Кассиор и другие некогда близкие соратники по революционной борьбе. Отец народов отнюдь не в одиночку совершал свои преступления и проводил жесточайшую политику индустриализации и коллективизации. В этом он опирался на преданных и безоговорочно послушных подручных. Команда Сталина – это еще и расстрельная команда. Конечно, эти люди не брали в руки оружие, но это они, не глядя и не колеблясь, подписывали расстрельные списки. На них кровь сотен тысяч невинных и оболганных. Главарь этой команды не нуждался в ее санкциях, советах и одобрениях. Все важнейшие решения он принимал единолично, но, видимо, хотел кровью скрепить своих подельников. Однако за коллективным конформизмом сталинской команды, пишет австралийский историк, скрывался не оставлявший их страх за свою жизнь и судьбу близких. И все же, парадоксальным образом, эти сталинские наркомы считали себя друзьями и проводили много времени в коллективных застольях и развлечениях с участием Сталина. Автор книги подробно характеризует каждого из них, пытаясь найти психологическое объяснение их слепой преданности вождю и последующему возвеличиванию его уже в относительно безопасные времена. Каганович умер в 1991 году, Молотов – в 1986. Вот как профессор Фицпатрик описывает в интервью «Радио Свобода» сталинскую команду, ее компетентность, образованность, социальное происхождение.
Well, they were not intellectuals, although some of them were quite energetically self-educated. If we compare them to their political competitors in the 1920s, that's to say that the group around Trotsky and the group around Zinoviev, they're definitely less educated and lower class, although for the most part not working class. There are a couple from the working class, Kalinin, I forgot to mention, also one from the peasantry. So first of all, they are lower class, they have experience in the revolutionary underground before the revolution, rather than having been in emigration. They become, I would say, they have, of course, no experience in government when they, with Stalin, step into their roles of running the country, but they acquire it. And some, I would say, acquire high levels of competence. Molotov and Mikoyan would be examples of that. Probably Beria also.
Вы пишете, что члены сталинской команды были не только коллегами, но и друзьями, что свободное время они проводили вместе в узком кругу. Причем вы подчеркиваете, что они встречались на даче Сталина исключительно в мужском обществе. Женщин на их застольях не было. Почему?
Absolutely, a pure male company. Well, I'm not sure that I can give an answer to that. It was an odd thing in itself to stay up most of the night. But it would have been even odder, wouldn't it, if you think about it, having women? That would have seemed like some kind of orgy almost. So I think that they that once you're on this very late night heavy drinking sort of mode of socialization, then you're not going to have women there. Earlier, the drinking was much less, and the activities were quite different. They were the sort of dacha activities.
А вам не кажется, что отсутствие женщин на сталинских застольях и посиделках объясняется грузинским обычаем, согласно которому женщины не допускаются к мужским застольям?
That's an interesting possible explanation, but earlier, after all, they did, and Stalin was as Georgian in the 20s as he was presumably in the 1940s. The country felt was much harder for me to judge. You know, we were quite circumscribed and could travel around. We certainly weren't not encouraged to go around the country talking to ordinary people too. But I would imagine it seems plausible that he did invite
Вы приводите мнение Троцкого о капитане сталинской команды, которого называете «играющим тренером». Троцкий считал Сталина второсортным ничтожеством, а его команду – третьесортной посредственностью. Вы согласны с его мнением?
No, I think that opinion of Trotsky, although understandable, Trotsky himself being a very high-powered intellectual, and Stalin's competitor, who was defeated by Stalin. It's understandable, but I think incorrect, and it's been very influential, at least in the West, in persuading people that Stalin was a mediocrity. It seems to me that if you look at his record, you look at him over time, if you look at the way he functioned with his team, where he is so clearly the leader, you can call him all sorts of things, but mediocrity doesn't fit.
Можно ли сказать, что все политические и тактические инициативы в Политбюро всегда исходили от Сталина, и что ему в его команде никто никогда не противоречил?
I don't think that's quite right, but in calling him a playing coach, in other words, a member of the team, but who also has a special status, I wanted to draw attention to that, to underline that special status. In other words, I think it's very clear that Stalin was absolutely the boss of his team, the leader of his team, and had a special status from the rest, although he regularly consulted with them. And now the notion is everything Stalin's initiative, and so he's doing quite a lot of things. But of course, there are other areas where members of the team are taking initiative. Is it a major initiative with widespread ramifications, not just relevant, let's say, to that would be taken without Stalin's close participation? Now, when Stalin had a radical idea, and he was the one who had them in the team most often, he clearly did like to try it out on the team. He liked to run it by them to see what kind of reactions he got. But the initiatives normally come from Stalin.
Существует мнение, что Сталин подбирал команду, исходя из принципа личной преданности, а не компетентности, профессионализма и образованности. При этом указывают на Ворошилова, Хрущева, Калинина, Андреева и других игроков его команды. Так ли это?
Well, loyalty was undoubtedly an important thing, and that would be a part of why he chose people. But I think he, on the whole, did not want to have incompetence around. There were some people who were or became not particularly competent. Perhaps Vodoshilov would be an example of that, who was an old friend and comrade from the Civil War days. But in general, I think he valued competence. He really valued the people who could do an effective job in whatever area they were put in, like Molotov, like Kaganovich up to the war. Like Mikoyan and like Beria, and the other thing he valued, I think, was health and work capacity. In other words, he really wanted people to be able to work hard and to be willing to people with to drop out, as happened with Andreev as he got ill. I'm not sure that I would agree about Khrushchev. It's sometimes said that he was valued as the working class member of the team. Not quite the token worker, but something along those lines.
Вы описываете команду Сталина как коллектив равных соратников. А были ли в нем персоны более равные, чем другие?
It's a very curious thing, isn't it? And it's counterintuitive, because given that it was so dangerous to be in high politics under Stalin, how come these people survived? It's particularly dramatic if you look at what happens to the level of where the rate of survival in the Great Purges is really, really very low, right at the top. Basically, Stalin was loyal to his team. In other words, he had a group around him, and loyalty to them, qualified loyalty, occasionally it was broken, was in a sense part of the unspoken pact. Now, Rigby, in making this argument, he made the comparison with a mafia group, in which the mafia boss is, of course, able to get rid of his team, and sometimes he does it, but normally he's not going to do it because that's a part of the process of bonding them to him.
Поясните, пожалуйста, подзаголовок своей книги «Годы опасной жизни в советской политике». Значит ли это, что все 30 лет существования команда Сталина находилась в постоянном страхе?
I wanted with that subtitle, which of course echoes the title of a film, but that's more or less just a joke. I wanted to emphasize that although the team, rather remarkably, almost all the team survives over 30 years of close work with Stalin, that doesn't mean that they were not in danger in that time. And above all, it draws attention to the fact that in Russian politics in general, Russian society in general, this was an extremely dangerous time. People fell victim of the Great Purges and also of other kinds of purges. The team can never, unlike everybody else, at least in the Soviet elite, the team could never feel completely secure.
Действительно ли в конце жизни Сталин вынашивал планы обновить свою команду, что неизбежно повлекло бы за собой новые репрессии?
It certainly looks that way. Undoubtedly, he was trying to get rid of Molotov, and looks like Mikoyan and Vodoshilov also. But I think plausibly that his aim was greater for a more or less complete renovation of the team. It was an extremely dangerous period for them, as that when one looks at Stalin's death, one cannot but feel how terribly convenient. However, as far as I can see, there is no convincing evidence at all that his death was anything but natural.
Отношение Сталина к своим подручным вы прояснили. А что думали о нем они сами?
This is very difficult, indeed, because we have some accounts from them, not all of them, of course, left accounts, but some did. Some accounts from them and some from their children, which emphasize that whoever it is that's being written about, Molotov, Khrushchev, Beria, whatever, that they were capable of standing up to Stalin, whereas others didn't. I think the testimony on Molotov is fairly, there's quite a lot of it. Khrushchev, in a way, makes less claims for himself. Beria's son makes big claims for Beria. I think we have to take it that Molotov quite often would maintain a position, but not one perhaps dangerously at odds with Stalin. The others would sometimes insist or rather strongly support a position that Stalin didn't seem keen on if it came within their particular sphere of concern. For example, Mikoyan, who was running trade, if it was a trade issue that he felt strongly about. I think because Stalin expected people to defend the interests of whatever area they were in charge of. Hence, he expected Vodoshilov to defend the military. So that kind of disagreement was not just permissible, but was expected.
Вы пишете, что в сталинской команде было неизмеримо меньше евреев, чем в ленинской. Можно ли считать это признаком сталинского антисемитизма?
I don't think I would put it quite like that, but it's clear that the Stalin in the 20s headed the faction, or he regarded as not the faction, but the anti-faction, that was opposed by two very Jewish factions. The Trotsky and the Zinoviev group are both strongly Jewish in their composition, Jewish intellectuals. I think Stalin undoubtedly had a feeling of otherness about he thought of those people as alien to him, but both because they're political competitors and because they're Jewish intellectuals. Now, clear, I don't see symptoms of any kind of serious anti-Semitism in Stalin before the late 40s, and then, as it seems to me, there is at least the possibility that the anti-Semitic campaign was primarily in his mind partly a response to popular anti-Semitism, a crowd-pleasing thing. There's only one Jew on the team, but that's Kaganovich, but nevertheless, about half of the team have Jewish wives, and if they're not, the proportion goes up if you count sons-in-law, including resident sons-in-law. So it would be a mistake to think of Jews as being excluded from the Stalin circle. It obviously was not so.
До сих пор ходит много слухов и спекуляций о смерти Сталина. Есть ли у вас сомнения в правдивости официальной версии его кончины?
I conclude that there is no evidence that this happened. Of course, evidence might have been hidden. I, however, think if Stalin's death were helped along by somebody, presumably the people would involved might be Beria. But I feel that this really cannot have happened, because if it had happened, people in Beria's case, since Beria was arrested and executed in December, was executed in December 1953, if there was any suspicion that he had been involved in Stalin's death, I cannot believe that it wouldn't have been raised. With regard to the other members of the team, they had such bitter quarrels in the period. The same thing applies. I feel as if there were any suspicion of involvement, accusations would have been made. So that's why I conclude that, in fact, his death was natural, although it's clear that there were quite striking delays in getting getting medical help, and the medical help that was got was not of a high level and so on. But also to the fact that that there had been arrests of Stalin's own doctors and among the Kremlin doctors in general.
Однако похоже, что Сталин жив. Чем вы объясняете вспышку его популярности в современной России?
I think in a way that popularity, well, it has to be attributed to the need for what's sometimes called a usable past. In other words, Russia needs to have its own narrative of its history, which lends self-respect, because the collapse of the Soviet Union obviously was a tremendous loss of status, if you can put it in those terms, in the international realm. So there's this crushing blow to the sort of sense of national self-respect, and when you try and consult, when you're constructing a usable past, one of the things that has to be in there is the period when Russia was a superpower and also the Second World War. Now, who was heading the Soviet Union at these times? That was Stalin. Therefore, I think that it's very hard if there is this concern to think to sort of recover self-respect as a country, very hard to get rid of Stalin in the history altogether.